Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We could sure make the news sound a lot better today if we could tell you just part of the story. The part that says the unemployment rate held steady at 5.5% last month. But as is usually the case with statistics, there's always another hand. The rates seemed to hold steady because of all the people who gave up looking for work. But employers actually pared their payrolls by 62,000 jobs. And wait, because there's even another hand. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat, available now. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad you're with us on this day before the holiday, the third day of July. And on the other hand, as we mentioned, you can trace that crumbling job market back even further than last month. The Labor Department also revised its reading for the month of May, adding an extra 13,000 lost jobs to that tally, which means we've lost 124,000 jobs over the past 8 weeks. Nariman Berevish is chief economist at Global Insight in Lexington, Massachusetts.
I think we're not done with the bad news. In fact, we think the jobs picture will continue to worsen for a while. For example, we think the unemployment rate will certainly head to 6%, maybe even a little higher in the next 6 months. So we're not done yet.
And Berevish worries that this puts an even tighter squeeze on our spending.
Consumers are facing at least four bits of bad news. One is certainly shrinking jobs. The other, of course, is gasoline prices, very high gasoline prices. And then you've got the stock market that's struggling. And then on top of all that, house prices are dropping in most markets. So this is not a good time for consumers, and they're predictably in a very bad mood.
Did he mention oil prices? Up to almost $146 a barrel today, more than 50% since the year began. Attention YouTube watchers. Big Brother is officially watching you. All those Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert quips you've been looking at could come back to bite you. A district court judge ordered Google to turn over records of every clip watched on its video sharing website. That would include your username and computer address. It's all part of a lawsuit the media giant Viacom filed against Google last year. Stacey Vanek-Smith tunes us in.
Last year, Viacom ordered Google to take more than 100,000 videos off of YouTube, clips YouTube users had posted from Viacom's MTV and Comedy Central. Viacom said YouTube needed to pay for clips of shows like Jon Stewart and South Park or take them down. A month later, it sued Google for $1 billion.
Maybe this would teach you to listen to authority!
Now a judge wants Google to turn over information on the people who uploaded and watched those videos. Industry analyst Rob Enderle says it's a huge blow to internet privacy.
One of the big concerns, of course, on the web is privacy. This clearly creates problems for folks that are posting videos.
People like film student Julie Soler, who watches and uploads videos on YouTube. She says she'll probably shy away from using the site now.
It does kind of leave an icky taste in my mouth regarding YouTube and Google and what I'm looking at online.
Google says it will ask Viacom to let it protect its users' identities. Michael Frumkin, a professor of law at the University of Miami, says the ruling could have broad implications.
The data that Google keeps on us gets bigger every second and gets more diverse every second. So there are going to be lots more cases like this.
Still, analyst Rob Enderle doesn't think Viacom will go after users. He says Google's pockets are looking pretty deep right now.
Remember, the networks are hurting for cash. That suddenly turns Google into the gold rush of this decade.
Enderle says damages could be huge, thousands of dollars per video clip. And he says other networks will be watching closely. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Have you heard that even the wages of sin are falling? The venerable Associated Press reported the other day that Nevada's legal brothels are offering gas cards and other promotions because business is off up to 25% from a year ago. Now another sign of hard times for Sin City, a big buyout deal that's in the cards for a year suddenly off the table. Racetrack and casino company Penn National announced today that two investment firms have dropped their $6 billion plan to buy it up. Gaming companies have taken a beating of late as consumers increasingly stay home. An industry that not so long ago billed itself as recession-proof now seems to be rolling snake eyes. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Whether you call it gambling or gaming, the industry has exploded in the last 10 years. But that's part of its problem. Joe Fath is an equity analyst with T. Rowe Price. He says the business isn't all rolling dice and one-armed bandits anymore.
It used to be primarily gaming-centric, and now there is also a large non-gaming component of spend, which I would argue is more discretionary. You can see that in the retail numbers. You can see that in the restaurant numbers of those publicly traded companies.
With so much of their revenue now tied to things like food and lodging, gaming companies are in trouble. Gas and food costs are rocketing, the price of plane tickets is soaring, and now airlines are cutting service to places like Las Vegas. Many gaming fans are staying home. Keith Foley covers the sector for Moody's Investors Services. He says while gaming companies did a good job of marketing themselves as recession-proof, the fact is that the new, expanded industry hasn't been around long.
And to suggest it's recession-resistant sort of discounts the fact that it never really went through a recessionary period.
It certainly is now. Foley says this lean period will be a good test of how different companies manage their costs and pull in traffic.
I don't think the interest in gaming has declined. I think the interest actually has increased in gaming. So I would expect that when the economy recovers, that in fact the industry would benefit from the recovery.
Until that recovery comes, gaming companies will continue to struggle, Foley says. Many of them are weighed down with debt and bankers are tightening the terms on those loans. Moody's has downgraded 17 casino companies this year. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Wall Street's tumblers came up two cherries and a lemon today. The Dow and the S&P 500 finished in the green. The Nasdaq stayed in the red. But the casino floor, trading floor, was fairly empty today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Never mind fears that it might hurt as much as help economic stability, the European Central Bank went ahead and notched up interest rates today. A rise in European interest rates boosts the value of the euro and attracts foreign investment. But on this side of the pond, the strong euro makes the dollar weaker. The fall of the greenback, on the other hand, isn't all bad news here at home. As Jeremy Hobson reports, it's also helping some well-positioned winners.
Under President Bush, the dollar has lost 40% of its value against the euro. To get a sense of the effect that's having on U.S. trade, I've come to Oakland, California, home to the fifth busiest port in the country. Port spokesperson Marilyn Sandifer has a front row seat to U.S. trade.
And we've seen a 12% increase in exports at the Port of Oakland in the first 4 months of this year compared to the first 4 months of 2007.
Imports, on the other hand, have remained flat. That's the typical outcome when the dollar falls. Exports rise because it's cheaper for foreigners to buy U.S. goods. Imports drop because we can't afford theirs. On the other side of the bay, there's a port of a different sort.
Hi, Ricky.
Hey, come on in.
At his house in San Francisco, Ricky Serban sells thousands of dollars worth of clothes each day on eBay to buyers around the world.
So my business is extremely high-end designer fashion.
Has the weakening dollar been good for your business?
I had a record month last month, so I can only assume yes.
So when people start talking about how we should try to strengthen the dollar, your answer would probably be no, leave it alone.
No, I want to travel to Europe to buy. This is the first year in 5 years I haven't traveled to Europe to do it on a buying trip. And my dollar's so weak, I'm dependent on what I can get in the U.S. right now.
It's the same story back at the Port of Oakland. Exports may be up, but Marilyn Sandifer says the 28,000 jobs the port supports are in jeopardy when imports slide. For instance, if imports are down, some of those truckers who usually haul shipping containers into the nation's interior sit idle instead.
What we would like to see certainly is a balance in trade. I think that's good for everyone. And we'd like to see the dollar regain some of its strength and see, you know, a 50-50 balance in terms of imports and exports. That's really good for the country and good for all of us.
The men hoping to occupy the White House next both say they want to strengthen the dollar. Barack Obama says the way to do it is to balance the budget and grow the economy. John McCain says reducing government spending will help, and he says we have to, quote, talk up the dollar in the short term. But Catherine Mann, a trade policy expert at Brandeis University, says don't forget about the flip side of the coin. Those high exports mean business for U.S. companies.
It's absolutely the case that the dollar depreciation is softening the magnitude of the economic slowdown that we're experiencing today.
And if history is any guide, the size of the slowdown will be key in determining which of the presidential candidates has the best shot of getting his face on a dollar bill one day. In San Francisco, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
You could say that's the way the ball bounces, but Americans haven't been paying as much attention this year to the men's quarterfinals playing out at Wimbledon right now. The most likely reason, all eight quarterfinalists ended up being from Europe. For a look at the effect of that on the business of sports in this country, we turn to our own Diana Nyad. Hey, Diana, it's finally summertime. We've got some things going on out there.
We've got a lot of tennis going on, and it's exciting in my book.
So we're heading into the men's semifinal tomorrow. How's Wimbledon doing? Are a lot of people watching?
You know, in Britain they're watching, or they were until Andy Murray lost, because he's the new big hope in Britain. But the American television ratings are just abysmal, Bob. They're rating under about a million people per match. If you compare that to not that long ago, McEnroe's, Borg's days, they're about 8 million people. So we have come down a lot in terms of TV fans watching tennis.
So what's going on here?
Americans, we've proven it through the years, need an American to watch. So Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal are now the two great players of the game in the men's side. And one's a Swiss, one's a Spaniard. They are brilliant. And we don't like them that much because they're not American.
Let me get you into the audience numbers a little bit.
Okay.
How do they compare, for example, to golf just a few weeks ago, the U.S. Open?
Well, of course, there's golf with Tiger and there's golf without Tiger. Of course, it was that sudden death playoff. It was watching Tiger hobble around heroically on his knee.
It was exciting stuff.
It was exciting, and the ratings turned out by that final day, the sudden death day, 13.7, which is a little over 14 million people. That's 10 times who's watching Wimbledon.
Well, you mentioned Roger Federer. He's a magnetic personality. Why can't he draw the same way Tiger Woods can?
Well, number one, we mentioned the American thing. It's not his fault. Number two, he is marketed as a suave, upper-class gentleman. I mean, the big advertisement that's running all through Wimbledon this year is Roger on his private jet. You know, he shows up in that cashmere sweater, and that's just not relatable. Whereas Tiger, we know he makes vast amounts of money, but climbs into a middle-of-the-road Buick. He's always with kids, popping a golf ball on the end of his club. And beyond that, golf worked very hard to get its sort of image away from that country club elite status. And it was the businessman's game. That's where all the deals of America were made. The public courses proliferated. And so even though we know it costs a lot of money to play a round of golf, even at a public course, it has this image that it's come down a notch off that. Whereas tennis, you know, back in the 70s, it was Billie Jean King and Jimmy Connors and Chris Everett all came out of public middle-class courts, but it swung the other way once they retired and became, again, and Roger Federer represents it, the untouchable, unrelatable country club sport again.
Okay, so how does that image translate into money for tennis?
The elite insiders don't think tennis is hurting. Roger Federer doesn't walk around after winning so far $40 million in prize money. He doesn't think tennis is hurting.
He's not hurting.
He thinks tennis is doing just fine, thank you very much. It's that everyman audience, it's that Super Bowl audience that tunes in the day of the big game who don't watch football all year. That's what football counts on. Well, tennis can't draw that crossover audience, that everyman audience. It's just not there right now.
You're telling us that tennis can learn a few things from golf.
I do. At this moment, I do. I think tennis could break it down and become that public courts game again. But they're going to need somebody besides Roger Federer to lead the way.
Diana Nyad, thank you for joining us.
Bob Moon, thank you very much.
Coming up, lighting fireworks is no breeze.
I tell people who are interested in coming into this field, that is going to be hard, hot, and sweaty work.
But first, let's do the numbers. In Wall Street's eyes, those pink slips for more than 60,000 of us could have been worse, and record oil prices aren't good for your wallet, but they are for energy companies. The Dow gained 73 points, or two-thirds of 1%, to end at 11,288. The Nasdaq nicked off 6 points, or one-quarter of 1%, to finish at 2245. The S&P 500 rose 1 point, or one-tenth of 1%, to wind up at 1262. For this short holiday week, the Dow ended down half of 1%. The Nasdaq shed 3%. The S&P 500 lost 1.2%. Today's jump in oil prices lifted ExxonMobil and Chevron around 1% each. The 10-year T-note slipped. The yield rose to 3.99%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Brand Week, the news organization dedicated to the information needs of strategic-minded marketing executives with real-time coverage. Now searchable at brandweek.com. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. It's a stress-free day on Wall Street. U.S. markets are closed for the holiday. On July 4th, 1776, the United States Declaration of Independence got the stamp of approval from the Continental Congress. And at that time, there were about 2.5 million people living in the nation, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. The population on this 4th is over 304 million. That's a lot of barbecue. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Rizdal. There shouldn't be any trouble making travel arrangements for President Bush next month when he heads for the Beijing Olympics. The White House announced today that he'll attend opening ceremonies. China is racing to the wire with final preparations, and new security rules that it's put in place for the Games are causing some big headaches for companies trying to do business there. Our China Bureau Chief Scott Tong joins us now. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. So what security restrictions are we talking about here?
There are a lot of new rules that are affecting foreigners here in China. In Beijing, I hear a lot about police knocking on people's doors and checking their passports. And for foreigners who are trying to get into China, it's getting really hard to get a visa to come in and do your business. So say I'm a businessman and I live in Hong Kong or in North America. And before, to get into China, it was pretty much a formality. It's pretty easy. Not a sure thing anymore. If you believe the tales that are out there, you have to go to the visa office and submit your college diploma. You need to show a letter of the company you're going to be visiting in China. You have to show your hotel reservation, and maybe you'll get the answer yes. So what it means is a lot of people can't get into China. It's getting a lot harder. And these people are basically the human lubricants of the China economy.
Yeah, what kind of people are we talking about here?
There are a host of different kinds of middlemen in China, but a lot of them are basically factory checkers, people who come in on behalf of Western companies and check for labor standards in factories. They check for quality control. And very often, they're kind of SWAT-teamed in and out of China from overseas. Well, it's not that easy anymore. And believe it or not, we're kind of getting toward holiday season as far as the supply chain. Orders need to be signed, and sewing machines need to get going. So something's going to give. Now, I spoke to Shanghai consultant Paul French, who watches this kind of thing, and he says more and more Western buyers are saying, you know what, forget China, I'm going to start to take my business elsewhere.
So people are tending to think, okay, now's the time that I really need to move the production to somewhere else. Because if you don't, you're going to miss Christmas. And whatever the Chinese government may think about the Olympics, the West is not going to move Christmas.
Okay, Scott, so if I'm a clothing brand label or a toy or shoemaker and I leave China, where do I go?
Well, you follow the cheaper labor, and that is places like Bangladesh or Vietnam, Cambodia, India. I mean, we're not talking about a wholesale exodus out of China, but in certain industries where the game is all about cheap labor, shoes, textiles, clothes. China, it's getting harder to compete as far as China's concerned. So in a way, China has its own kind of China threat, if you will.
Well, I can see an even darker scenario. If I'm an American company and I can't get folks in to check quality, what if I just skip it?
Well, there is some skipping. I spoke to an exporter in Hong Kong today, and he said the quality assurance stuff is either getting too expensive or it's impossible that it's not happening with certain kinds of exporters. And, you know, it only takes one more of these bad toy cases to show up on the front pages of the newspapers to taint once again the brand China image. And the whole point of the Olympics for Beijing is to polish up that image.
Well, you mentioned the Olympics. Any indication that these visa restrictions are affecting tourism in Beijing?
Well, foreign visitors to China are down 14%. And hotels, which promised that they were going to be jacking up prices three or four times their normal price, well, those prices are starting to come back down to normal levels right now. There's a great headline in one of the newspaper articles writing about it. They said, you know, Beijing is once again the forbidden city for foreigners.
Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Scott Tong, thanks for joining us.
All right, Bob, you're welcome.
Here's hoping you have a sparkling 4th of July weekend, although we're painfully aware that in some places the only red glare will be coming from the frustrated faces of citizens who've been told the money just isn't there this year for the usual community fireworks displays. This year everybody is getting less bang for the buck. We've got a look at how that might be affecting the holiday weekend across the country from a new member of the Marketplace team, Mitchell Hartman.
The folks who put on the Boston Pops fireworks show haven't taken any bang out of their 4th of July extravaganza. Macy's in New York and Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco will be just as spectacular as ever. Some smaller towns, though, are cutting back or canceling due to higher costs. So far, local distributors have been able to get all the backyard explosives they need. Steve Graves is head of the Indiana Fireworks Users and Distributors Association.
I think the one thing that retailers have noticed is the increase in price, which, as it's our understanding, will increase again next year.
Graves says wholesale prices are up in Indiana 15% to 20%, and supplies are getting tighter. China, which makes nearly all U.S. fireworks, has cut shipments for safety reasons. Julie Heckman is executive director of the American Pyrotechnics Association. She says the port of Shanghai isn't exporting any explosives until at least mid-October, part of security measures for the Beijing Olympics.
We are nervous about moving forward for our fall holidays like Labor Day, as well as the fireworks season between Christmas and New Year's Eve.
Heckman worries that some exhibitors may have trouble getting all the fireworks they need, but she says the splashiest shows will still sparkle.
We're getting away from just the traditional red, white, blue, green, and gold, and we're seeing a lot more softer colors, beautiful pastels, pinks, and lemony yellows and chartreuse.
Other trends include 3D special effects like double Saturn rings and fishtails that streak across the sky. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
From sparklers to more sizzlers, time for another installment in our summer series, Hot Jobs.
We're having a heat wave.
A lot of us who are lucky enough to have a fireworks display within affordable distance will be packing our blankets and picnics and heading for the show this weekend. We stopped in at one of our local amphitheaters here in Hollywood, where cymbals clash and pyrotechnics crash, especially on the 4th of July.
My name is Eric Elias. I'm the pyrotechnic operator in charge of the Hollywood Bowl. The shows of the Hollywood Bowl are a little bit unique. We are performing to a live orchestra. The gentleman who designs the choreography is a masterful artist, and oftentimes less is more. And he's painting not only with light, but he's painting with darkness.
Show scheduled to end at 10:35. 4 minutes before that, we're supposed to start on the finale.
They are long days, and I tell people who are interested in coming into this field that it's going to be hard, hot, and sweaty work.
There's a lot of sitting and waiting. That's right. And complaining while we wait.
We figured out once that the average on my crew is about 5.5 years of college. So it's a fairly eclectic group. I have engineers. I've had several attorneys, two physicians. I have a lot of students. I've had actors. And I have one woman who's a rocket scientist. I don't think the audience needs to know the nuts and bolts and the arduous labor that's involved in setting up one of these shows to enjoy it. I think part of it to me, part of what they enjoy, and part of the mystery of fireworks is seeing it appear seemingly out of nowhere. Seeing the fire arise in the darkness. I can remember being out at Jones Beach on Long Island watching 4th of July fireworks shows being put on over the water. My most vivid recollection is sitting there during a show, and I must have been only 7 or 8 years old, and a large piece of cardboard debris coming down on the sand next to where our blanket was perched. And I remember being fascinated by this meteorite landing next to me. And I picked it up, and I remember it was warm, not hot, and it had that smell. And there's an old quotation which appears in every issue of one of the pyrotechnic publications, and it says, "He who hath smelt the smoke is ne'er again the same." And there is a significant amount of truth to that.
Caitlin Carroll helped us out with that report. You can see photos of Eric and the Hollywood Bowl fireworks display on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, another sign that Detroit is beating a retreat from high oil prices. General Motors says the automaker is considering a new Chevrolet mini car. A spokesman says bringing the Chevrolet Beat to the U.S. market is among the options being studied. It would be about the size of a Honda Fit or a Toyota Yaris mini car. GM unveiled the Beat with two other ultra-small vehicles as concept cars at auto shows last year. At the time, it said they were designed to attract young buyers in urban markets around the world. Well, given oil prices now, they could have broader appeal. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow hiked up 73 points, 2/3 of 1%. The Nasdaq fell 6 points, 1/4 of 1%. The S&P 500 added 1 point, 1/10 of a percent. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, John Haas, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, walking a rocky road toward energy independence.
The idea that the U.S., the world's single biggest energy consumer, can be independent of the world's single biggest business is ludicrous on its face.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.